You are listening to the epic fantasy novel Lion's Last Kill, and this is Chapter 12. If this is your first experience with this novel, you might want to go to my website and start from Chapter 1. That's at www.castlefiction.com. If you like epic fantasy and that kind of thing, you can also check out my other website, www.stormthecastle.com. Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you enjoy it, and here is Chapter 12. They spent the rest of the afternoon in good spirits. The thought of a secure camp and a fire, which meant warm meals, had lifted everyone above the mood they had previously been sunk into. After a few hours, they arrived at the base of the mountain and the camp. In their slow upward climb, they curved around some boulders as big as houses, and the camp had revealed itself to them. It reminded Bosch of a lagoon. The large boulders formed a semicircle around a small cave that was nestled into the side of Hoch. Those boulders afforded them excellent cover from the landscape that slowly climbed down and away from the mountain. As they entered this stone lagoon, the smell of cooking food hit them. Two scouts were in the camp with their horses. They were sitting around an ice campfire enclosed in a circle of stones. Several small pots were suspended over logs. The two scouts, hearing their approach, looked up from their cooking and smiled. Then they ran over to the arrivals. Bosch looked them over. They were worn and haggard, and it wasn't from the weather or from the breck. Bosch could see that it was something else that was wearing them down. It was the force of the oracle. And this weariness had definitely taken a large toll on them. It had muted their normally keen senses. Being scouts, they should have been very well aware of the party's arrival well before it happened. Instead, they were busy looking over their cooking and didn't notice anything or hear anything until Bosch and the party were right inside the camp. This made him a bit uneasy. These men were going to have to stay here for at least another 5 days while he, Varga, and a few of the others made the ascent. He looked them over a little more carefully. One of them was a lieutenant. He was probably the leader of the scouting expedition. He approached and saluted as Varga dismounted. "Good to see you, sir." And almost as an afterthought, the lieutenant looked down at his clothes and roughly ran his hands over his tunic in an attempt to make himself presentable to the commander. While he reported to Varga on the situation, they all brought their horses into the dusty lagoon and started unpacking their supplies. "I have two scouts still out. I sent them to different areas so they could watch for your approach. They will return by nightfall. It's been quiet here the past few days, but the strain on us has been high. The Oracle's been taunting us in a way. It makes us tired. But we're holding up well. This is a good camp here." He waved his arms to present the camp to Varga. "In the evening, the horses can stay out here, and the soldiers can sleep inside the cave. To the north of us is a small grassland. It's decent enough grazing for the horses, and there is some small game so we can replenish our food stocks. Water's been a problem, though. We're running low on it, and have not yet been able to find any streams, nor has it rained. The grasslands don't exist on anything, though. There's got to be some streams up around there, and we'll find them. I thought it better to secure your arrival first. We can start looking for water once your group starts the ascent." His brow furrowed at this last statement. It was almost as if he were hoping that Varga would tell him they were going to forget about the ascent. Sensing that he was finished with the report, Varga put his hand on the lieutenant's back. "You've done well. Let's go take a look inside the cave." And although this wasn't the cancellation of the quest that the lieutenant was hoping for, it did lift his spirits. And his posture straightened, and his chest stuck out slightly. While Varga and the lieutenant made their way toward the cave, the rest of his party unpacked their horses. Bosch approached the scout that was still tending the fire and the food that was cooking on it. "Well, what you cooking there?" The man was hunched over the pots and didn't look up at the question.
I hunted some quislings down in the grassland to the north.
He lifted the lid off the pot, and the smell made Bosch's mouth water. It was a stew, and it looked pretty good. Maybe just a little thick. A good stew is a tricky thing to make. But the life as a scout is one where he spent days, even weeks at a time, living off the land. Scouts had the reputation of being good cooks. They could find vegetables, herbs, and meat where none was thought to be had. And quislings were small rodents, much like rats. Normally a person wouldn't consider to eat them, but this stew smelled really good, and Bosch thought it probably tasted pretty good too. The scout picked up a wooden bowl and ladled some of the stew into it, then handed it to Bosch. He took it and thanked the man. And resisting the urge to just stand by the warmth of the campfire, he took the bowl and head toward the cave. The warm stew steeped through the wooden bowl and comforted his hands. He looked at the dark entrance. It wasn't much of a cave. It was almost a depression in the side of the mountain. The entrance was about 15 feet across and about 10 feet high, and the cave itself seemed to extend about 20 feet into the mountain. They wouldn't all be able to sleep in here tonight, he thought. Some of them would have to sleep outside near the campfire, which wasn't too bad after all. By the time evening fell, they had all become comfortable. Everybody had a warm meal, and those of the soldiers that hadn't been on guard duty had warmed themselves near the fire. The air temperature at the base of the mountain wasn't cold, but the unfriendly feel to it was reminiscent of cold. Varga and Mazur had spent the last several hours going over the supplies and materials they would need for the climb up the mountain, and when they were done, he gathered up all the people that would make the climb. The six of them stood in an informal circle outside the cave, and Bosch found himself looking at the other members of this new group. He and these five others would make the arduous climb. They seemed ready for it. Varga cleared his throat and started the informal meeting by declaring that Mazur would be the climb master. He was well trained in climbing, and Varga also said that from this point on, Mazur was in charge of the party, and all the orders would come from him. As if on cue, Mazur lifted his voice and took over the meeting. I'm the climb master for this, and that means I'll be in the lead position. Behind me will be the assistant climb master. He pointed at one of the men, and they all looked at Bryak. He continued on and pointed at each soldier as he called them out. Third and fourth positions will be Varga and Bosch. Then the final two climbers will be Sturm and Brime. The two most dangerous positions in a climb like this were the first and last positions, so they would keep Bosch and Varga in the middle, because they were most important, and also because they were least experienced in climbing. The order hadn't been settled. Mazur took them over to the packs, and he went over them. Each of them would be carrying a heavy pack that was complete with food, water, rope, cold weather clothing. And each pack was an individual kit into itself, and it was enough for any man to return back down the mountain alone. It was important that this mission not be lost because they had lost one man and lost something critical that was in his pack. They all hoisted their packs and tried them on for fit, and Bosch was surprised at the weight of it. It had been a while since he did any backpacking, or mountain climbing for that matter. He knew he would quickly adjust to it, as he quickly adjusted to the horse ride, but a small part of him hoped that most of the weight in the pack was food and water. That way, as the climb went on, it would get lighter and lighter. Satisfied with the fit and comfort of the pack, he took it off, and unpacking it, he went through all the materials. There was cold weather clothing, including a pair of rugged fur-lined overshoes, a pair of gloves and a hat, a tent, four packs of food and three scrinstones. Two of the scrinstones were the size and shape of a flashlight. One of them was a heatstone, and the other was a breathstone. The third scrinstone was smaller, and it was a speakstone. It was about the size of a golf ball. This was so that they could communicate within their climbing group if needed. One of the men, probably Mazur, would be carrying a larger speakstone so they could talk to the main camp here at the bottom of the mountain. He was glad it wasn't him carrying it. Toward the top, it would become very burdensome. On the outside of the pack was a large coil of rope, 4 water canteens, and an assortment of climbing tools, including a small pickaxe and a variety of pitons and climbing rings. Once they had all finished inspecting their packs and repacking them, Mesa spread out a rough drawn map of the mountain, and they all looked it over. "We're going to take the safest route up, Hawk. If all goes well, it will take us 3 days to climb up and 2 days to climb back down. Before nightfall each evening, we'll set up a camp, and the first 2 camps will be at these predetermined locations." His finger pointed at spots on the map. "The 3rd camp will be somewhere close to the summit." He circled a large area on the map with his finger. "In the morning, after that 3rd camp, we will depart from there to summit her. Then, when we are done with what we need to do, we'll return to that camp by nightfall. We shouldn't spend the night at the top. The danger of thin air sickness is too great, and as we ascend, keep an eye on each other for the signs of it. If need be, we'll bring a man down to save his life, or at least far enough down to save his life. Thin air sickness can cause death. I advise you all get some sleep tonight, because the sleeping for the next few days, much like the air, will be very thin." With that, they sensed that the meeting was done, and each filtered off to do different things. Bosch headed straight back to the campfire. He retrieved his sleeping bag and unrolled it alongside the other soldiers, who had also thought it a good idea to sleep near the warmth. He settled in and fell into a restless sleep. Again he found himself walking in the jungle. He was on a path, and the foliage of the jungle had crept in from the sides and from above, so the path was clogged. This slowed his progress, but he kept walking. There was no log in his path this time. The sound of the jungle animals and insects was like a metronome that pushed him forward. He broke through the foliage and found himself standing at the top of a very high cliff. It was as if he were on top of a mountain. He stared down into a beautiful valley a mile below, then across at another mountain on the other side of the valley. His eyes went back down to the center of the valley. In it was a large fire. It burnt with a ferocity, and it was much too large to be a campfire. It was a wildfire, and he judged that from the distance he was at, it probably spread for miles. In time, it would consume the whole valley, then race up the side of the mountains. It was a painful glob of golden red that was killing everything. He stared at it, feeling sorrow for the creatures that would die, and he watched in fascination as a small blob of orange red separated itself from the larger fire. From where he stood, he was standing at the top of the mountain cliff overlook. It was just a pinprick. He was mesmerized by this little pinprick of orange red, and he just stared as it headed in his direction. If it was fire, why didn't it leave a path of fire in its wake? Why didn't it ignite the forest in the valley? It continued its movement toward him, and it got slowly brighter. He was paralyzed with curiosity, watching it as it reached the end of the valley and continued up the side of the mountain directly toward him. He called to Babbage for help, but Babbage was silent, and that made him feel very alone. For him, not getting an answer from Babbage was like going to make a step and discovering you had no legs. And as if he had no legs, he continued to watch the orange-red glow of fire grow and come toward him. As it got closer, it took on a shape, and out of the foliage below him, he could see it was an animal. And it was running, and just before it pounced on him, he saw that it was a lion again. This time, its coat was a glow of fire. But for the lion, it was a natural fire. It seemed right. It covered the last few feet to him with a long leap, and with its predatory roar still in his ears, its extended claws inches from his eyes, and its fiery coat shedding a sickly warmth on him, he awoke. Bosch was glad when morning broke. His sleep had been terrible. Terribly restless. And the dream was unsettling. He was anxious to be moving along with the quest, and the anticipation of seeing the Oracle was probably worse than actually seeing her. He second-thought this. No. Seeing the Oracle would be worse if they ever completed the climb. This mountain could be unforgivable. It wouldn't notice them climbing. It wouldn't care if they disappeared in a landslide, fell off a cliff, or just died for lack of oxygen. This made him think about the Oracle. It was probably the same case with her. Would she care if anything happened to them? Probably not. And the ironic thing about that was that she already knew what would happen to them. Bosch, Varga, Mazer, and the other three climbers in the party separated themselves from the rest of the soldiers that were making use of their mourning. Someone had started a second campfire to the north side of the cave opening, and this is where the six of them gathered. They ate their breakfast in silence. And when they were done, Mazer handed out a new pair of shoes to all of them. Bosch looked these new shoes over carefully. Then, seeing that Mazer was already wearing a pair, he slipped his onto his feet. They were comfortable, but more durable than his riding shoes. The sides were soft leather, but the bottom was of a hard rubber-like material. He scuffed his feet along the ground as if he were ice skating. They gave really good traction, he thought. This rubber-like material on the bottom was well-suited for climbing. This must be a really new development here. He'd never seen anything like this. This comfort and the adequacy of the new shoes lifted his confidence a little bit. Funny how a good pair of shoes could change a disposition. But for good reason. His feet were where he and the mountain met. And they were what he would feel his way with. They cleaned up their breakfast mess, and each of them went over the straps on his pack, carefully checking for any problems. Then, without a word, they donned their packs and made their way out of the rock lagoon. This is the end of Chapter 12. Stay tuned for the next episode, Chapter 13, First Day's Climb. Hi, thank you for listening to this episode of Lion's Last Kill. Hope you're enjoying it. And remember, if you like stuff like this, or you want to listen to the first chapter, go to my website, www.castlefiction.com, or www.stormthecastle.com. There you can also check out my epic fantasy blob, the Big Barbarian's Epic Fantasy Blob.